This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
The first hour of the Cincinnati Inquirer on Tuesdays is brought to you through generous underwriting from PNC Foundation.
Hello, everyone. This is John Pauley, and it's Tuesday, April 30th. You know what that means. It's time for the Cincinnati Inquirer business section. Today in history, and Section A, which covers the local, national, international news. First off, we have a BusinessWise article by Tom Cooney and Crystal Faulkner. This is the business section. It's entitled, Should You Keep It? Toss It? Some Tax Document Retention Guidelines. And here's the question. We recently filed our business returns for 2023. And would like to eliminate old documents and files. Can you share the general guidelines as to how long to keep important documents? And the answer? We all felt relieved after filing our 2023 income tax returns. But if your office and home have reams of paper consisting of years' worth of tax returns, receipts, canceled checks, and other financial records or digital versions of the same confusing mess, a spring cleanup is a good idea. However, be sure to follow these retention guidelines. General rules. Retain records that support items shown on your tax return at least until the statute of limitations expires. In most circumstances, the statute of limitations is a 3-year period after you file your return. However, there are situations where the IRS can look back 7 years. Therefore, we recommend you keep supporting documents for 7 years from the due date of the return or the date you filed, whichever is later. However, certain records should be kept longer. Deeds, easements, real estate documents for property you still own are examples of documents you should retain permanently. Contracts, mortgages, notes, and leases that are still in effect should be retained. Legal documents such as custody agreements, divorce papers, bills of sale, and birth and death certificates should be kept permanently. Retain records related to your retirement plans, including IRAs, permanently. Some business specifics. Records substantiating costs and deductions associated with business property and investments are necessary to determine the basis and any gain or loss when the property is sold. According to IRS guidelines, you should keep these for as long as you own the property plus 7 years. The IRS recommends keeping employee records 4 years after an employee has been terminated. In addition, you should maintain records that support employee earnings for at least 4 years. Also, keep employment tax records for 4 years from the date the tax was due or the date it was paid, whichever is longer. For travel and transportation expenses, supported by mileage logs and other receipts, keep supporting documents for 7 years. Regulations for sales tax returns vary by state. Check the rules for the states where you file sales tax returns. Retention periods typically range from 3 to 7 years. Examples of business-related items you should retain permanently include general ledger and journals, depreciation schedules, year-end financial statements and tax returns, minute books, entity organizational records such as stock certificates and bylaws, trademarks, and patents. Additionally, IRS audits and determination letters related to tax liabilities should be kept permanently. When in doubt, don't throw it out. If you are unsure whether you should retain a document, a good rule of thumb is to hold on to it for at least 7 years. We recommend consulting with a tax or financial professional before doing any major purges, but use this season as an opportunity to start cleaning things up. It will make all the difference to be more organized when tax time rolls around again. And Crystal Faulkner, one of the co-authors, is a CPA and certified professional EOS implementer working with leadership teams to increase the value of their organizations. Tom Cooney, the other author, is a CPA and a senior financial advisor with Wealth Dimensions, an investment advisory firm. Tom can be reached at 513-554-6000. For additional information, call 513-768-6798 or visit online at mcmcpa.com. You can listen to Tom and Crystal daily on WMKV and WLHS on BusinessWise, a morning and afternoon radio show that profiles highly successful people, companies, organizations, and issues throughout our region. And there is a business article here right next to the other BusinessWise article. It's entitled, Greater Cincinnati Joann Stores Will Remain Open Despite Filing for Bankruptcy. This is written by Amanda Garrett of the Akron Beacon Journal. About 6 weeks after filing for bankruptcy, Joann Incorporated, Thursday afternoon, said a federal judge has approved its plan to reorganize, remain in business, and operate as a private company. Joann expects to successfully complete its financial restructuring and emerge from the court-supervised process in the coming days, the company said in a press release issued from its Hudson, Ohio headquarters. The company has said all along it hoped the bankruptcy would allow it to reduce its debt by over $500 million while keeping its more than 800 stores open and fully operational. Joann's operates several stores in Greater Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky. Thursday's announcement said the company will, quote, preserve the jobs of its more than 18,000 team members, end quote, as part of the Chapter 11 bankruptcy restructuring. Chris DiTullio, Chief Customer Officer and co-lead of the interim office of the CEO, called the restructuring a, quote, significant milestone, end quote. We could not have reached this point without the unwavering dedication of our team members, the continued support of our industry partners and landlords, and the tremendous loyalty and enthusiasm of our customers, he said in a release. Scott Sekela, the company's CFO, and other co-lead of the interim office of the CEO, added that the company was grateful to financial and industry stakeholders who enabled Joann to keep operating in recent weeks. Those stakeholders, which Joann did not name, will now own and operate the company as a private entity. With a strengthened balance sheet and improved liquidity, we are better positioned to work collaboratively with our vendors, business partners, and landlords, and ultimately to inspire the creativity in our customers that helps them find their happy place, Sekela said in a release. And that wraps up the business section for today. Now we'll move on to Today in History, which is on page A2. And today in history, today is, whoops, let's get that taken care of. Oh, that was interesting. I clicked on Today in History and it came up with the article about Joann's again. So anyway, today in history, today is Tuesday, April 30th, the 121st day of 2024. There are 245 days left in the year. On this date in 1492, Christopher Columbus was given commission of exploration by Spain. On this date in 1803, the U.S. and France concluded negotiations for the Louisiana Purchase, with the U.S. agreeing to pay France $15 million for 828,000 square miles of land west of the Mississippi River. On this date in 1812, the territory of Orleans became the state of Louisiana and the 18th U.S. state. On this date in 1926, Bessie Coleman, the first African-American and Native American woman to hold a pilot license, died at age 34 when her plane malfunctioned and plummeted 3,000 feet in the air during a practice flight. On this date in 1945, German dictator Adolf Hitler and his wife, Eva Braun, killed themselves in a bunker in Berlin to avoid capture as Soviet forces stormed the city. Their bodies were then carried to the Reich Chancellery Garden and burned. On this date in 1975, Saigon fell to North Vietnamese troops, marking the end of the Vietnam War. On this date in 1993, CERN launched the World Wide Web into the public domain. Conceived by Tim Berners-Lee, the WWW was initially created as a way for scientists in universities and laboratories to share information globally. On this date, finally, in 2009, Chrysler filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy and entered into an alliance with Fiat. The automaker failed to make a deal with its creditors, from whom the company borrowed almost $7 billion. The last-minute deal with Fiat and another government bailout of $8 billion helped the company through its bankruptcy reorganization. And now we go on to the front page of today's Enquirer. There are two articles and one little blurb. The first one is the blurb, Born to be Wild. Let's see if we can pull that up. Okay, Born to be Wild. It has a photograph here of a couple of people with an animal. I'm not sure what kind of animal at this point, but we'll know in a second. They are very happy. They're smiling big. Looks like they're feeding the little animal and petting it and holding it and that kind of thing. The caption reads, Jenna Wingate, senior keeper on the left in the picture, and Dara Kelly, animal keeper, bottle feed Maisie, a lesser kudu, that's a K-U-D-U, on Wednesday in Africa the Habitat. Maisie was born January 15th to mom Sabi and dad Hobbs. A fun fact, males have spiraled horns to defend themselves. Their large ears detect prey like lions and painted dogs. And this animal is the size of a good-sized dog. It's got stripes across its back that run from top to bottom. And, you know, so it's an interesting-looking animal. And now we'll move on to the article, or the little blurb they have about it. Zoo babies at the Cincinnati Zoo, born to be wild. The Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden celebrates the 2024 class of zoo babies. Among the new arrivals, Kai, that's K-A-I, a bat-eared fox, Bateared fox, B-A-T-E-A-R-E-D, fox, Violet, a Cape porcupine, and Maisie, a lesser kudu. The zoo is also showing off some of the other youngsters, like Fritz the hippo. The zoo will be celebrating Mother's Day on May 12th with free admission for all moms. And then I think there's an article on page 4A with more mostly photos, so we'll get to that. And now we'll get to one of the other articles on the front page here. UC expands campus with dorm complex. $100 million project includes four buildings and 1,300 beds. This is by Sidney Franklin of the Enquirer. Construction will begin later this summer on a new four-building dorm complex with 1,300 beds and 20,000 square feet of recreational space at the University of Cincinnati. The school's Board of Trustees voted last week to allocate $36 million toward the project on the northwest corner of East McMillan and Vine Streets. With that money, local contractor Turner Construction will begin excavation on the 2.1-acre site, install utilities, order HVAC and electrical equipment, and build a parking podium underneath the future residential buildings. Taking over this long vacant plot of land, which straddles Scioto Lane and sits across from the CVS Pharmacy in Clifton Heights, will mean that the university is expanding south from its campus boundary north of Calhoun Street. Between Vine Street and Scioto Lane, Block 1 will feature three separate housing structures connected at the ground level, as well as a recreation center and 125 to 200 parking spaces. Only one residential building west of Scioto Lane will be built in Block 2. A police safety substation will also be incorporated into the site at the request of the local community, according to the university. The University of Cincinnati will purchase the land from the Clifton Heights Community Urban Redevelopment Corporation, also known as CHCURC. Last October, the board approved $8.5 million for the acquisition. Current estimates suggest that the overall development will cost $100 million. The project is anticipated to wrap construction in summer 2027. More housing needed at UC to accommodate growth. The decision to purchase the extra land is an attempt to ease the current housing crisis that's faced the university for the last few years as it experiences record growth in the student population. Demand for university housing is expected to increase by 25% over the next 6 years, according to the Board of Trustees' April 23rd meeting minutes. In the aftermath of COVID, demand for urban housing overall, locally and nationally, is rising, and this includes the area around UC's Uptown campus, wrote the university's Board of Trustees in its minutes. UC's appeal as a destination campus and our mission as a transformational engine for regional talent demands, workforce development, and educational opportunities requires planning for growth, it said. Both the school and private development groups are trying to capitalize on the need for student housing by renovating and building more large-scale projects on and near campus. And here's what those projects are. After completing an $80 million renovation of 57-year-old Calhoun Hall, the university's largest housing facility, Siddall Hall, next door, is undergoing a revamp set to open this fall. Another one, on the west side of campus at Straight Street and Stratford Avenue, Chicago-based real estate firm Core Spaces will open Hub Cincinnati to university students later this year. The amenity-rich complex includes 380 fully furnished units and 1,112 beds. Another is a shuttle ride away from campus. 136-unit rental complex, the Vanguard, is rising on a 4.5-acre site east side of Interstate 75, also opening this fall. And that wraps up that article. And now we'll continue on with the other front page article entitled Billie Eilish to Play Cincinnati on November 8th. World tour to promote her forthcoming album. This is by Victoria Morwood. Billie Eilish is coming to Cincinnati to promote her forthcoming album. The 9-time Grammy Award winner will perform at Heritage Bank Center on November 8th as part of her international Hit Me Hard and Soft, the tour. Eilish's third studio album, Hit Me Hard and Soft, comes out May 17th. It was co-written and produced by her brother, Phineas. The November concert will be Eilish's first time performing in Cincinnati. According to Setlist.fm, the last time the 22-year-old pop star performed in Ohio was at Cleveland's House of Blues venue in 2018. The North American leg of Hit Me Hard and Soft, the tour, starts in September and continues through December. Eilish will perform throughout Australia, starting in February 2025, and continue through Europe from April to July. Eilish is partnering with Reverb, an environmental nonprofit, for the tour. A portion of North American ticket sales will go toward the organization, and two eco-villages will be staged at the venue, where fans can connect with nonprofits. According to a press release, fans will also have access to plant-based concessions and water bottle refill stations. Where to get Billie Eilish tour tickets? Pre-sales for tickets start Tuesday. General ticket sales begin Friday at noon. Get tickets at BillieEilish.com and Ticketmaster. And that's BillieEilish.com or Ticketmaster. And here's the Billie Eilish North American Tour dates. September 29th, Quebec and Quebec City, Centre Videotron. On October 1st, Toronto, Ontario, Scotiabank Arena. On October 2nd, Toronto, Ontario, Scotiabank Arena. On October 4th, Baltimore, Maryland, CFG Bank Arena. October 5th, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Wells Fargo Center. On October 7th, Detroit, Michigan, Little Caesars Arena. On October 9th, Newark, New Jersey, Prudential Center. On October 11th in Boston, Massachusetts, TD Garden. On October 13th in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, PPG Paints Arena. On October 16th in New York, New York, Madison Square Garden. October 17th and October 18th also at Madison Square Garden in New York City. On November 2nd, Atlanta, Georgia, State Farm Arena. November 3rd, also Atlanta, Georgia, State Farm Arena. November 6th, Nashville, Tennessee, Bridgestone Arena. November 8th, Cincinnati, Ohio, Heritage Bank Center. November 10th, St. Paul, Minnesota, Xcel Energy Center. On November 11th in St. Paul, Minnesota, also at the Xcel Energy Center. November 13th, Chicago, Illinois. November 14th, Chicago, Illinois, at the United Center. November 16th, Kansas City, Missouri, at the T-Mobile Center. November 17th, Omaha, Nebraska, at the CHI Health Center, Omaha. On November 19th, in Denver, Colorado, at the Ball Arena. On November 20th, the same, Denver, Colorado, at the Ball Arena. December the 3rd, Vancouver, British Columbia, Rogers Arena. December 5th, Seattle, Washington. December 6th, Seattle, Washington, both at the Climate Pledge Arena. December 8th, Portland, Oregon, the Moda Center. December 10th, San Jose, California, the SAP Center at San Jose. And the same on December the 11th. On December 13th, Glendale, Arizona, Desert Diamond Arena. December 15th, Inglewood, California, Kia Forum. On December 16th, also at Inglewood at the Kia Forum. And also on December 17th at Inglewood at the Kia Forum. And that wraps up the concert dates for Billie Eilish. And now we'll move on to the inside part of the paper, where we can pick up a couple more articles. First article here is criminal charges against former Mueller president are dropped. Hizdu was arrested in March in Nashville. This is by Cameron Knight of the Enquirer. Prosecutors have dropped the criminal charges Wednesday against James Marshall Hizdu, the recently resigned president of Archbishop Mueller High School. Hizdu, age 45, was arrested outside a Nashville bar in March. He was charged with criminal trespass, public intoxication, and disorderly conduct, all of which are misdemeanors. He was placed on leave from his job and resigned April 3rd. According to a police complaint, security guards said Hizdu was, quote, following women around, making them feel uncomfortable, and causing them to become annoyed with the defendant, end quote. Police said he was kicked out of the bar, but then repeatedly tried to get back in. Hizdu's next hearing was scheduled for June 6th. His attorney, Ben Rabin, explained that the prosecution filed a written request to dismiss the charges Wednesday. As Mr. Hizdu's attorney, I am pleased to announce that all charges against Mr. Hizdu have been dismissed. Mr. Hizdu did not, and has never, harassed anyone, which is why he was not charged with harassment, Rabin said in the statement. These accusations were misreported by certain media outlets without basis. Mr. Hizdu looks forward to putting this incident behind him and to focusing on a healthy and productive future for himself and his family, he said. Affidavits signed by Prosecutor Jose Sarabia described the circumstances surrounding Hajdu's arrest. Rabin said the documents filed dropping the charges did not state the reason for the decision. And that's the end of that article. Now we'll move on to It's Official. 15-year-old girl catches largest blue catfish ever in Ohio. So this one's written by B.B. Hodges of the Enquirer. It's official. A 15-year-old New Richmond girl now holds the record for landing the largest blue catfish in Ohio. The Outdoor Writers of Ohio crowned Jaylin Parker with the title Saturday, almost 3 weeks after her 101.11-pound catch. I've been biting at my nails waiting for them to call, the New Richmond high school sophomore said over the phone. Jaylin caught the monster on April 7th while jug fishing on the Ohio River. The fish weighed nearly as much as the young fisher. It was so heavy she needed the help of her dad and their family friend to pull it in. While the family instantly knew this fish was special, only the Outdoor Writers of Ohio could confirm it was a record breaker. The organization has maintained Ohio's official angling records since roughly the 1940s, said Fred Snyder, chairman of the Outdoor Writers of Ohio Record Fish Committee. Jaylin's fish had to undergo an extensive vetting process before being classified as a record breaker. A professional biologist must identify the fish's species, the fish must be weighed on a scale certified by the county auditor, and the Outdoor Writers of Ohio must confirm all laws were obeyed while catching the fish. Members of the Outdoor Writers of Ohio then vote to approve the record change. The Record Fish Committee votes first, followed by the Outdoor Writers of Ohio's entire membership. Snyder said Jaylin's fish was approved. The new Ohio record for blue catfish replaces that previously held by Chris Rolfe of Williamsburg, who caught a 96-pound blue catfish in 2009. Jaylin learned the good news Saturday while pole fishing for bluegill at a family's friend's pond. She said she and her family caught about 120 bluegills. She and her dad might go fishing again tonight. So that is a pretty amazing story. So the new record again is 101.11 pounds. And now we'll move on to the next page of the Enquirer. And this is where we have several photographs of these animal babies. See if we can get this to pull up without a whole lot of problem. Okay. The zoo babies at the Cincinnati Zoo. This one shows a little furry animal, looks like about the size of a cat. Looks like they're feeding it or administering some medicine or something. Let's see what the caption reads. Sammy Villa, head keeper of the Animal Ambassador team, feeds Kalahari, or Cal for short, on Wednesday. He's a bat-eared fox, born on April 5th to mom Frankie and dad Otis. He weighed 0.3 pounds at birth and now weighs 0.7 pounds. He'll be at the animal hospital until he's finished bottle feeding. Then he'll be part of the Cat Ambassador program. Fun fact, its ears, up to 5 inches long, can move independently to pinpoint prey. Using their ears, they can hear a termite chewing grass. Wow. Okay. And next we have another photograph. This one shows one of the zookeepers. Looks like she's brushing or petting another animal. And the caption reads, Senior Keeper Renee Carpenter stands Wednesday with Mokonzi, M-O-K-O-N-Z-I, a male okapi, born December 17, 2023, to mom Kuvua and dad Kaloro. Fun fact, okapis are members of the giraffe family. Their foot-long dark tongues allow them to clean their eyes and ears. They also have a similar gait to giraffes. So there's that. It's a pretty tall animal. It comes up almost to this lady's shoulder, and it's got some striping on it and some black and white legs. And next photograph shows a cheetah playing with a ball, as a cat will do. Rosie, Rozi, a cheetah, celebrated her second birthday last weekend. Her companion is Daisy, a 2-year-old border collie shepherd mix. The two have been together since the zoo acquired Rosie as a cub, or Rosie as a cub, when her mom couldn't care for her. Now, they don't show the companion border collie. And next we have a friendly face of a hippopotamus. And Fritz was born August 3rd, 2022, to Mom Bibi and Dad Tucker. He weighed 80 pounds at birth and now weighs 1,018 pounds. His famous sister, Fiona, weighed 29 pounds at birth. Visit the bloat in Hippo Cove. A fun fact, Fritz was a surprise since Bibi was on birth control. Males can weigh up to 4,000 pounds. They can't swim, which is why they have the nickname River Horse. And that wraps up that part of the paper. Let me move on to the next page. Okay, let's see. Pair charged after incendiary device tossed in grocery store. This is by Quinlan Bentley of the Enquirer. Two people are facing federal charges in connection with an incendiary device being launched into a local grocery store late last year. Donald Donatelli, age 28, and Angela Schweitzer, age 35, are charged in federal court in Cincinnati with conspiring to commit malicious damage and destruction of a building in interstate commerce. Donatelli is facing an additional charge related to directly causing the damage. Court records show the charges were filed in March but unsealed Wednesday. In November, Donatelli threw a Molotov cocktail-style incendiary device into the Treetop Grocery in Spring Grove Village while the owner and his wife were inside the store, according to a news release from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Ohio. Donatelli and Schweitzer arrived at the store together in a white BMW, with Schweitzer acting as the getaway driver after Donatelli threw the device inside the store, officials said. A month after the incident, Union Township police arrested Donatelli on open warrants while he was driving a white BMW, a Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives special agent wrote in an affidavit. Donatelli was also captured on surveillance footage, arriving at the store in a white BMW and walking around inside several hours before the fire was started, according to the court document. Investigators later uncovered a Snapchat video Schweitzer sent to Donatelli of a man dressed in black approaching the store's front glass doors and throwing something inside, causing an, quote, "an explosive fire," end quote, the special agent said. While the fire was quickly contained and extinguished, smoke harmed many of the store's products, resulting in roughly $300,000 in damages, Cincinnati Fire Department officials said. No one was injured in the blaze. Federal court records did not list attorney information for either Donatelli or Schweitzer as of the publication of this report. While the pair were originally arrested on local charges, they've since been moved to federal custody. If convicted as charged, Donatelli and Schweitzer face a possible prison sentence of at least 5 years and up to 20 years, officials said. All righty, next article we have. Shooting in Winton Hills kills one woman, injures another. This is by Aaron Valdez of the Enquirer. A woman was killed and another was injured in a shooting in Winton Hills on Saturday afternoon. Officers responded to the report of a shooting in the 6300 block of Center Hill Avenue at approximately 2:44 p.m., according to Cincinnati police. When they arrived, they found two victims suffering from gunshot wounds. Cincinnati Fire Department personnel determined that one of the victims, 40-year-old Leah Choma de Jimenez, was dead at the scene. The second victim was transported to the University of Cincinnati Medical Center in stable condition. Police have not said what led to the shooting, as the investigation is still ongoing. They have also not released any information on suspects at this time. Anyone with information about the shooting is asked to call the Cincinnati Police Department Homicide Unit at 513-352-3542. And then we have one more article on this page. Parents plead guilty in death of diabetic child fed mostly Mountain Dew. This is by Quinlan Bentley of the Enquirer. Just 4 days before she died, Carmody, K-A-R-M-I-T-Y, started showing signs of a, quote, serious medical issue, end quote, while at home, prosecutors said in a court filing. The parents of a 4-year-old Claremont County girl, who prosecutors say died of complications from diabetes after being fed mostly Mountain Dew through a baby bottle, have pleaded guilty to charges related to their daughter's death. Christopher Hoeb, H-O-E-B, the girl's father, pleaded guilty Thursday to involuntary manslaughter, and her mother, Tamara Banks, pleaded guilty to the same charge in March, according to documents filed in Claremont County Common Pleas Court. Hoeb, age 53, and Banks, 41, were indicted in July on counts including murder, involuntary manslaughter, and endangering children. In exchange for their guilty pleas, prosecutors have recommended the remaining charges be dropped. Hamilton County Coroner's Office records show Carmody Hoeb died at the Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center on January 25, 2022. Carmody suffered neglect and abuse for the majority of her life, and her parents denied her proper nutrition and medical care, according to prosecutors. The girl's death was a result of diabetic ketoacidosis, a life-threatening complication of diabetes most often associated with type 1. Just 4 days before she died, Carmody showing signs of a serious medical issue while at home with her parents, prosecutors said in a court filing. Those symptoms worsened as the days progressed, prosecutors said, with Hoeb and Banks not calling 911 until the child turned blue and stopped breathing. First responders were able to revive the child for a short time before taking her to the hospital, where doctors performed brain scans that showed she was brain dead. An autopsy revealed that Carmody died from a diabetes-related brain injury. Prosecutors said Carmody lived with undiagnosed diabetes, and her death could have been prevented with proper treatment and care. Carmody also suffered from a condition that caused her teeth to dissolve due to her being fed sugary soda through a baby bottle. Prosecutors said Banks would often mix baby formula with Mountain Dew, long after Carmody should have been weaned off a bottle, and that investigators were unable to find evidence of the child ever visiting the dentist. Banks also has several other grown children who were treated poorly in her custody, including a son who fell into a coma at 4 years old from previously undiagnosed diabetes, according to court documents. While the boy recovered, prosecutors said Banks continued to neglect his medical needs, failed to have him seen by a doctor, and never attended his follow-up visits. Hoeb and Banks face a maximum possible prison sentence of 11 years. Under a state law that says the Department of Rehabilitation and Correction can extend someone's sentence based on conduct while in prison, the pair could serve up to 16 and a half years. Prosecutors have recommended Hoeb serve a 7-year sentence, though no such recommendation has been made for Banks, court records show. Banks is set to appear in court again before Judge Victor Haddad on May 24th for sentencing, while Hoeb won't be sentenced until June 11th. Alrighty, now we'll move on to another article here. The Ohio State protest arrest called deeply appalling. This is by Sharon and Hendricks of the Columbus Dispatch. Several students, staff, and faculty organizations are calling out Ohio State University for how it handled an anti-Israel campus protest last week, that resulted in nearly 40 arrests. 36 people were arrested Thursday night as Columbus began the latest site of student protests against Israel, when hundreds of Ohio State students, faculty, and community members rallied and set up tents outside the student union. Among the 36 arrested, 16 are undergraduate or graduate students at Ohio State, according to a university release. The other 20 are not affiliated with the university. One of the groups that organized Thursday's protest was Ohio State's Student for Justice in Palestine, SJP Ohio chapter. In a letter posted to its Instagram account, the group called the police response to Thursday's actions excessive, aggressive, and, quote, deeply appalling, end quote. The group said it pitched an encampment Thursday with five demands of Ohio State. Quote, financial divestment, academic boycott, financial disclosure, acknowledge the genocide, and end targeted policing, end quote. Rather than responding appropriately and reasonably through negotiation, the Ohio State University called on the Ohio State University police and state troopers equipped with riot gear to escalate a peaceful gathering, the group said. This occurred just hours after OSU positioned snipers on the union rooftop aimed at students, it said. Protesters said Thursday night that they saw armed officer on the roof of the Ohio Union, which overlooked the protest on the South Oval, pointing firearms down at them. The Lantern, Ohio State's student newspaper, originally reported around 8 p.m. Thursday that university spokesman Ben Johnson confirmed the Ohio State Highway Patrol troopers on the roof were unarmed. Johnson said the information he gave Thursday was correct at the time, but he said Friday afternoon that once law enforcement began using force to arrest protesters around 10 p.m., protocol changed, and those on the roof did have long-range firearms. Ohio State Highway Patrol provided overwatch support, which is a standard safety measure when they assist with large gatherings, Johnson said. We don't discuss specific public safety protocols. In general, overwatch support is armed, and the team carries standard equipment, including firearms, that would only be used reactively to protect the safety of all present, including demonstrators. SJP Ohio said officers moved in to arrest protesters as a number of Muslim students congregated for evening prayer. Other students tried to form a human chain around those praying. Officers with riot gear pushed on all sides of the encampment structure, shoving people into those in prayer, causing people to fall on top of tents, and knowingly creating a stampede where students were trampled while attempting to seek refuge, the group said. The deliberate decision to assault students during prayer is deeply appalling, it added. In a statement published Friday, Ohio State said its, quote, priority is always the health, safety, and well-being of our students, faculty, and staff. Arrests are not an action that we take lightly, and we appreciate the support of all of our law enforcement partners to disperse the encampment for the safety of our university community, end quote, the university said. We always have and always will take the action that is in the best interest of our community, it said. SJP Ohio called attention to reports received from those arrested about their treatment by officers during arrest and at the Franklin County Jail. Reports included hijabs being ripped off and not returned once in jail, taunting, not being permitted to pray, strip searches in the presence of male officers, and no access to kosher or halal foods. Ohio State's undergraduate student government's president and vice president said in their own statement posted to Instagram that Thursday's protest, quote, was handled in an unacceptable manner, and we share the outrage and disappointment expressed by many in the Buckeye community, end quote. Student body president Bobby McAlpin and student body vice president Justin Robinson called on Ohio State to reevaluate safety protocols to better ensure student safety during, quote, high-tension situations, end quote. They said they are working on plans to address over the summer break to, quote, truly advocate for the student body, end quote. USG set up an anonymous feedback form for students to share their experiences from the protests. It plans to use the testimonies, quote, to advocate on behalf of the student body to Ohio State's administration and Department of Public Safety, end quote. In addition to students expressing their discontent, some Ohio State faculty and staff also shared their concerns. Faculty and Staff for Justice in Palestine at the Ohio State University, FSJP, condemned OSU's decision to authorize law enforcement. There were no OSU administrators present to speak with students. There was no acknowledgement from OSU leadership that, while they may disagree, the university has a responsibility to protect students' rights to peaceful protest, the group wrote. Instead, the entire gathering faced police forces, including CPD officers who have a track record of using lethal force and aggression against Black, Indigenous, and other community members of color, it said. FSJP said Ohio State, quote, deliberately chose to create an environment of force and intimidation, even as it claims that its actions are in students' best interests, end quote. The group said it also heard a number of accounts of, quote, unnecessary levels of violence, end quote, as well as religious discrimination that took place after individuals were arrested. All those arrested were released on their own recognizance without having to pay any bond and are scheduled to have their first appearances in Franklin County Municipal Court early this week. In solidarity with Ohio State student organizers, a group of advocates in Hilliard plan to gather Sunday evening at Station Park. The group is also gathering to support Hilliard City Council members who passed a resolution earlier this month calling for peace in Gaza. And if you'd like to write the author of this, shendricks@dispatch.com. Talks fail to end protest at Columbia. Protesters rally ahead of deadline to vacate. This is by John Bacon and Eduardo Cuevas of USA Today. Out of New York, Columbia University ordered pro-Palestinian protesters to disband their encampment Monday after school representatives and student organizers failed to negotiate a resolution of the standoff that began almost 2 weeks ago and fueled similar protests on campuses across the nation. A small group of academic leaders has been in constructive dialogue with student organizers to find a path that would result in the dismantling of the encampment, school president Manoush Shafik said in a statement Monday. Regretfully, we were not able to come to an agreement. The school issued a notice to the protesters asking them to, quote, please promptly gather your belongings and leave the encampment, end quote, by 2 p.m. If they identify themselves to a university official and sign an agreement to abide by all university policies, they will be eligible to complete the semester, quote, in good standing and will not be placed on suspension, end quote, the notice advised. John Ben Menachem, one of the main student organizers, posted on social media platform X that members of the Gaza Solidarity encampment face, quote, mass evictions and interim suspensions, end quote, if they don't leave. The Columbia Students for Justice in Palestine posted, quote, do not sign anything with administration. Show up at noon to protect the encampment, end quote. Students vowing not to leave the encampment began gathering at midday for a rally ahead of the university's 2 p.m. deadline. No business as usual, they chanted from the encampment. There is only one solution, some yelled. Intifada revolution. The protesters demand that the school halt investments with companies profiting from Israel's war in Gaza, and they want amnesty for students and faculty involved in the protest. Shafik said the university offered to convene a faculty committee to address academic freedom, to create an expedited timeline for reviewing socially responsible investing and to invest in health and education in Gaza. She noted that, quote, external actors, end quote, had contributed to creating a hostile environment that drove some Jewish students and others to leave campus. Shafik said the school will not divest from Israeli companies and will proceed with its graduation ceremony set for May 15th. College campus protests ramped up after rallies elsewhere in the U.S. against a civilian toll in Gaza, where more than 34,000 people have died since the Israeli invasion in response to a Hamas-led attack that killed almost 1,200 people in Israel. College campus U.S. students are not alone in protesting the war in Gaza. While students at the University of Georgia set up a, quote, Gaza solidarity encampment, end quote, on Monday morning, demonstrators at Paris's Sorbonne University were chanting Free Palestine at the university's gates as some students set up tents in the courtyard. Video from the Shabura refugee camp in the southern Gaza city of Rafah shows signs in support of the campus protests, CNN has reported. Some read, students of Columbia University continue to stand by us. And thank you, students, in solidarity with Gaza. Your message has reached us. Blankets, trash, and anti-war placards were all that remained Monday at a pro-Palestinian encampment at Virginia Tech, hours after school officials cited an, quote, increasing potential to become unsafe, end quote, and called in police to disband the three-day protest. The school, 260 miles southwest of Washington, D.C., becomes the largest in a growing line of universities to take police action to curb protests of Israel's war in Gaza. Through constant dialogue between university officials, the Virginia Tech Police Department, and protest organizers, we were able to maintain a safe and peaceful environment through much of the weekend, the school said in a statement, adding that the protest continued to grow. The protesters were told to disperse voluntarily and warned that those who remained would be charged with trespassing, the statement said. I transferred to Virginia Tech hoping to find a supportive environment, which I did, but unfortunately has disappointed me over and over and over again, Palestinian student Fatima Hassan told news station WSET-TV. Virginia Tech police referred USA Today to a school spokesperson who did not immediately respond to a request for information on the number of arrests and other details of the police action. Author Pam Zhang and educator Sophia Noble have withdrawn as keynote speakers at the University of Southern California's Rossier's doctoral and master's commencement ceremonies. In an open letter to the school, Zhang and Noble criticized USC for failing to conduct good faith talks with student protesters and for bringing armed Los Angeles Police Department officers onto campus to break up a pro-Palestinian encampment. The duo also lashed out at USC for canceling a commencement speech by valedictorian Asna Tabassum after pro-Israel groups objected to Tabassum's support for Palestinians on social media. USC later canceled its primary undergraduate commencement, although some satellite ceremonies are taking place. To speak at USC in this moment would betray not only our own values, but USC's too, the letter stated. We cannot overlook the link between recent developments and the ongoing genocide in Palestine, it said. The protesters opposed to Israel's military attacks in Gaza say they want their schools to stop funneling endowment money to Israeli companies and other businesses, such as weapons manufacturers, that profit from the war in Gaza. In addition, protesters are calling for a ceasefire, and student governments at some colleges have passed resolutions in recent weeks calling for an end to academic partnerships with Israel. More recently, amnesty for students and professors involved in the protests has become an issue. Protesters want protections amid threats of disciplinary action and termination for those participating in demonstrations that violate campus policy or local laws. All righty, now we'll move on to another article. New poll shows Trump leading Biden by 6 points. This is from Melissa Cruz of USA Today. Former President Donald Trump leads President Joe Biden by 6 percentage points in a new national poll from CNN, with nearly half of voters saying they are planning to place their support behind Trump this fall. 49% of those polled say they are expecting to vote for Trump in the 2024 election, compared to Biden's 43%, according to the survey released Sunday. Trump's support remains basically unmoved from CNN's last poll in January, while Biden's has dropped 2 percentage points, down from 45%. Biden does not fare much better in a five-way matchup between himself, Trump, Green Party candidate Jill Stein, and independent candidates Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Cornel West. In that scenario, Biden garnered just 33% of the vote, while Trump held 42%. Kennedy polled at 16%, siphoning the vote away from Trump and Biden. West polled at 4% and Stein at 3%. Even as Trump faces four sets of unprecedented criminal charges, his favor among some Americans has continued to rise. 55% of voters say they now view Trump's first term as a success, while 44% see it as a failure. Americans' tendency to look back at past presidencies with rose-colored glasses is common. Still, the overall opinion of Trump's presidency has markedly increased since he left office. A January 2021 poll taken days after the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol showed that 55% of voters considered Trump's presidency a failure. The polling for Biden, now well into his first term as president, does not benefit from the same retrospection. Among those polled, 61% call his presidency a failure, and 39% said it's been a success, according to the poll released Sunday. The chunk of Americans calling Biden's presidency a failure has risen by 4 percentage points since January 2022. That number appears to reflect voters' feelings on several issues, including negative impressions of his handling of the economy, inflation, and student loan debt. His lowest rating stems from the Israel-Hamas war, with 71% disapproving of his handling of the conflict. And there's one more paragraph. I think I can finish that. The CNN poll was conducted in mid-April using a random national sample of 1,212 adults, including 967 registered voters. The poll's results among registered voters had a margin of sampling error of plus or minus 3.8 points. And that will wrap it up for today's Cincinnati Enquirer Business Section and Section A. This is John Pauley for Radio Reading Service and the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. Have a great day.